Recyclical, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclical's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclical Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Joseph Schachter, founder of the Schachter Energy Report online at schachterenergyreport.ca. He's speaking to us from Calgary. Welcome back to the show, Joseph.
My pleasure. Good to be with you, Jim.
Joseph, if somebody was looking at being involved in an investment bank in California, they might be getting some bad news. Can you tell us about the sad state of a bank there?
Well, there's banks that have, over the last couple of years, they couldn't put money to work, so they ended up buying 1-, 2-, and 5-year paper from the U.S. Treasury. And, of course, interest rates have gone up so much, and the banks can't hold the deposits because they can't pay high enough interest rates. And so the people are leaving and taking their deposits away. So you have two problems. Banks with low-yielding assets from Treasury government bonds that they bought a year or two ago, and then they can't attract new money. And the biggest problem is in the San Francisco area, and there's a company called their SVB, San Fran Savings Bank, or SVB, SAM, B for Barry, and it's draining down 70% today because they've announced that they need to raise more capital, and all the assets that they've got on the books are underwater. So we also saw Credit Suisse today, one of the biggest European banks, get beat up because the SEC is saying that the documentation that they filed is incorrect and that they're not going to accept it. So you've got European banks getting beat up. You've got even the stalwarts in the States, Bank of America, J.P. Morgan, Wells Fargo, are all getting hit today. So rising interest rates is now having, casualties in the banking sector. If the banking sector has casualties, there's going to be other casualties.
Mm-hmm. Now, is this a sign people should be worried about their banking accounts or that their local bank might fail? We do have deposit insurance, but if that was a savings and loan, it may not be covered by deposit insurance.
I would say for Canadians, it's not an issue, because of, CDIC and the size of our banks and the power of our banks, the diversification of our banks, that's not an issue I wouldn't be concerned about. In the United States, if you are a regional bank and you're tied into lending to a specific area, let's just say it's real estate in Atlanta or, as I mentioned, the SVB in San Fran, if you're involved in a localized market that has a disproportionate assets in areas that are under duress, those are the ones that I would be wary of. And if you look at, there's an ETF of the small banks in the United States, the regional banks, it's down 7% today the last time I looked. So there's some nastiness in the market. If you look at the general market, there was a concern that if the Dow broke down below the 32,300 level, we would, and we're very close to that. On the other one was the S&P 3940. We're below that now. So if they close on Friday below those levels, the 200-day moving average levels, which are the downside, which has held so far, watch out below. We could see multiple thousand points go off on the Dow in the coming months. Tomorrow, the big thing, of course, is the jobs report. They're looking for a number of 210 or more. If it's more than 210, it tells you the Fed's going to have to be very tough and longer keeping their rate structure going higher. And again, The inflation data has not been very good. Unit labor costs have been going up. Biden, in his new budget, is planning to offer all government employees a 5% wage increase before they even get, you know, upgrades in their rating levels, which gives them more money. So it's almost like Biden's giving the finger to Powell and the Federal Reserve and saying, eat that and try to solve your inflation problem.
Right. Wage inflation really hasn't been the problem, though, has it? Wages have not kept up to inflation over the last two, 3 decades. And it's an impossible attempt right now. They're still not getting hikes of 9%, or in Canada, with inflation running just under 6%. We're not seeing generally wage rises that high.
We are seeing that areas where the labor has the ability to price itself higher. For example, Delta just did a contract 34% over, I think, 4 years, 14% in the first year. So airline pilots, which are in short supply, are able to do it. Railway unions, because of the shortage of manpower, and of course they're expanding, and you know, they need more of them now to make sure that there's safety on the damn, on the darn, rails. They're getting wage, there's a pressure. Anyone that, that has any ESG skill set, is being rated from one company to another at double-digit increases. So if you're in an area, nurses, doctors, anyone that's in a short supply industry, teachers are getting very, very significant wage increases, much above inflation. On the other hand, minimum wages have not really rallied for the individual, let's say working in a restaurant or a small store. If you work for a Walmart, or you will work for, McDonald's, you've been getting, 14%, increases to, 14 to $17 wage, start wages, because they've been desperate for wages and they can, for people, and they can afford to buy the people, which hurts smaller retailers that can't afford to pay these kinds of wages. So it, and the offset to that is, if you're in a high tech job, you're at where Amazon, Microsoft, IBM, where they're doing, layoffs, you're a highly paid individual and you're looking for a job. So it's really a weird market, on the job side. Selective areas where there's pricing power, most areas where there's not.
Mm-hmm. And if you're smart enough to know how to code, you can learn how to do those other jobs as well.
Well, if you can swing over and learn about climate change, and the number of company meetings that I've listened to where they talk about building up their skill set on carbon capture, on methane capture, on emission stuff, everything to meet 2030, 2050 targets. Those people, if they come out of university with that skill set and have a couple years' experience, can write their own tickets at very big wage increases.
So the hot job markets, I think you've already talked about it. How does that affect the energy sector?
Well, the energy sector is not really doing a lot of hiring. There still is, except in the, in the field, there's a shortage of people at the drilling rig side, the frack side. Listening to the conference calls of the companies reporting their Q4 results, a lot of them have been saying that manpower is the issue and that they have to train them. There's beginning to be some crews where there's been some inexperience and there's been some accidents. So, of course, that's something the industry doesn't want, and the producers, E&P companies hiring them, don't want. So everybody's focused on making sure that the people they have are as well-trained as possible, so we do not have, accidents. But, as we saw with the Imperial announcement with Curl, they have a problem. They keep their mouth shut, and even the government doesn't say anything. People start worrying about the trust in these big companies. Norfolk Southern, over all the different accidents they've had on the rail side, TransCanada over the leak that they had in Kansas. If companies are not keeping up and not watching everything, and something happens, the best thing to do is come clean as quickly as possible and get in there and do what you have to do to make it better. But anybody who hides the event is definitely on a critical list in terms of investor confidence.
On that one accident, it seems the Alberta government was complicit in the secrecy.
Yes, yes, and I think we'll probably hear from Rachel Notley, saying this is another abuse of government from the UCP, and they're just shooting themselves in the foot by not coming clean right away. You know, if the people are worried about stuff like this, you do not hide it.
We'll have more with Joseph Schachter right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Joseph Schachter. Joseph, I think what a lot of people are wondering right now is, are we going to see a late summer, early fall, huge hike in gasoline prices like we saw last year?
Well, I'm looking for the price of WTI, which is 75.5, and it was 80 a week ago, to go below 70, because you have weaker demand in the United States. China's recovery is not what everybody said. For example, I'll give you from the EIA data, the weekly petroleum report that came out on Wednesday. U.S. demand this week was 19.05 million barrels, down 1.36 million from a week before, 20.4. And when you take the cumulative daily average from this year versus last year, we're down by 8.8%. So we have a big decline here in consumption. And that really is the big issue, that we have, demand weakening, because, again, people have limited budgets. And so with the price of oil going up, they're saying, maybe I won't drive as far. So I think that's having an impact. We have enough supply. Both the EIA and others are showing that the supply are there. And people need to realize we're just heading into spring, when demand is usually lower. Versus the, home heating season, where you use distillate and heating oil. So I think we're going to be looking at lower prices. In Canada, that might be anywhere between 5 and 10 cents a liter going over the next few months. But once we head into summer, if the economy has slowed down enough, and there's not going to be much more raising of interest rates by either Central Bank in Canada, the States, or the ECB, and China starts showing a little resilience, I think we will see higher oil prices. My guess is that we will exit 2023 and into Q1 of 2024 in the $90 a barrel level. And as I mentioned, we're 75.5 today. So we're down from 130 in February, March of 2022 after the invasion. The low so far in 2022 was 70.08 in December. I think we will go below that over the next month or two, but that might be the low. And that is also when I think we're going to be putting out a lot of buy recommendations on the energy sector, because the stocks will react to these lower prices. As you remember, as you are probably fairly aware, natural gas prices have been creamed here. They were, $8 to $10 at the high, and they're now around $2.50. And so we're near the low for what could be for natural gas prices. And again, we have two engines to our industry, oil, liquids, and natural gas. Natural gas is already in the doghouse. I expect we'll see lower oily prices. The only saving grace for Canadian companies, not for the U.S. companies, is our wonderful price of our Canadian dollar, which seems to be heading lower and lower because the Bank of Canada doesn't keep up with rate moves in the States, and because we're already seeing a slowdown in the Ontario and Quebec economies. Of course, the central bank wants to care about what's going on in those two areas. And if they're showing sluggishness, then the Bank of Canada won't be so aggressive keeping up with U.S. rate increases. And we may be looking 2 weeks from now on the Wednesday, where the consensus was that the Fed would raise rates by 25 basis points. Powell's now put that one away. And the implication and the view now is, we're probably going to see 50 basis points, depending upon the data between his testimony before Congress and the Wednesday meeting. And if tomorrow's data is hot on the labor side, next week you get CPI, you get industrial production, you get retail sales, you get PPI, all of those before the Fed meets. So the PPI, the Fed will have a lot of data to make the determination. And if it's hotter than consensus or flat or up versus the last series of data points, the Fed will have to continue to be hawkish, raising interest rates, tightening money supply, and slowing the U.S. economy down. And if they slow down, we slow down.
And the figures for Canada have been flat. We're expecting no growth. We haven't had any significant growth. The Bank of Canada didn't hike rates when they last met, which was the first time in over a dozen meetings. Is Canada going to kind of wobble along with the U.S., or we've already wobbled and now we're just waiting for them to crash and squash us even further?
Well, the fourth quarter data for Canada was flat, but in December it was negative 0.1%. So we're watching the monthly data. And if the United States catches cold, Canada catches pneumonia. So if the U.S. economy goes into slowdown recession, which a lot of people are now thinking could be in Q2, Q3, two negative quarters was the old definition. With the negative money supply, the 2-year yield trading 100 basis points over the 10-year yield, all of these are indicators that historically have led to recession. And remember, there's also the Fed is doing quantitative tightening. They're not doing much on the mortgage side because people aren't renewing mortgages because rates are going up, not down. So you want to keep your mortgage. So there's not a lot of money coming in there. But they continue to let run down their treasuries. And so as they mature, they're not buying them back, which means quantitative tightening is taking money out of the economy as well. So between higher rates, the price of money going up, and liquidity coming down because of the maturities, we're seeing a tightening phase that at some point will start hitting across the economy, not just the financial sector, technology. You know, whenever you see interest rates go up, technology gets beat up, like the NASDAQ or the Russell 2000. They're getting hit disproportionately hard today. But the Dow and the S&P have both broken, assuming we close where we are when we're discussing, and they close on Friday at the same rate or lower, then we're looking at a technical breakdown in the stock market, which usually leads to a 15 to 20% decline in the markets. And that can happen over a few weeks, as we all know, from 2020, from 1987, 2007, 2008. When markets break the breaches, they go down hard.
Now, I keep seeing articles saying Canada has missed the boat on LNG. Could Canada get back into the global LNG market, or is it too late? Australia and the U.S. have beaten us to it.
Well, the U.S. has built almost everything. The one plant that was being repaired is now coming back online, so another 2 BCF. The LNG Canada, 2.1 BCF, should be on in 2025, but they're in the process of making the decision to double that by another 2 BCF. You've also got Woodfibre moving forward with Enbridge behind it, and you have Cedars, which has the support of Pembina. There's also a number of others, that are some smaller, but a lot of them with First Nations support. If they go through, we could have 5, 6, 7 BCF by the end of the decade on the west coast of Canada, and we would be a player. And remember, the logistics of taking LNG tankers from the Gulf of Mexico through the Panama Canal to South Korea or Japan or China, et cetera, Vietnam, versus taking it from the west coast to Canada, we have a significant advantage. So let's hope we get off the pale and get our act together and get more projects approved.
Stuart Muir from the ResourceWorks Society points out one of those LNG tankers carries over $100 million worth of product. So if just one a day is leaving BC, and with government royalties, taxes, fees, and so on, that's a huge boom for the BC provincial economy.
It's very, very beneficial to them because of a number of things. One, the revenues they get from the royalties from the province. They also, of course, have taxes on the companies operating, because many of them will be taxable very quickly because of the high prices. the people working along the routes, the First Nations, will be able to get a lot of jobs. And then people who are non-First Nations who are working for the construction companies or at the LNG plants, they're going to be paying taxes both federally and provincially. So this is a gangbuster opportunity. The bigger the pie, the more you grow the economy. Everybody wins if you can do it in a climate-friendly and you can do it in a way where the fiscal packages are fair to everybody. And that's what seems to be happening with the LNG business. We took two decades to get our act together. It looks like we finally may be getting closer to making that a reality. So I'm in the optimistic camp that LNG Canada will say we're going for train two. Having Enbridge and Pembina behind, two projects, I think that's a good thing. First Nations on side with those projects. It seems like all the boxes are being ticked properly. And you even got the BC government realizing, hey, this is good money for us.
Now, getting to the numbers side, how is the rig count in Alberta doing and the job situation in the oil patch?
Well, the job count is right across from, Saskatchewan, BC, and Alberta, but mostly in Alberta. But the last count we had was, the Canadian rig count was 246. So the maximum number of rigs we can put manpower on is 250. And that's up from 217 a year ago, so up 13%. So the industry is running flat out. But remember, at some point, we go into breakup. We won't see the rig count go down as much as it's done in the past because a lot of drilling now is done on pad drilling. And so the rigs are able to move along the path from drill location to drill location on pads. So we will not see the number go down to the extreme low levels that we usually see in the old days before pad drilling and multi-well pads, where people do 6 to 10 wells on a pad. All of that has changed, and that's also why drilling costs have been coming down and why we've seen more efficiency and more productivity from the wells.
How eco-friendly are Alberta's oil wells?
Well, there's sour wells, so you've got to handle sour gas. Heavy oil and oil sands requires diluent to move it. So there are issues that we have to take care of. The mining of the oil sands is an issue. Creating the steam is an issue. But the industry has gone for example, on fracks and on drilling rigs are going to dual fuels, and many of them are going to be just natural gas fired. So you don't have diesel, which is a lot more climate impacting with the emissions. And then you also now are getting where if you're close to a community, you can put in electric lines, and you're now hearing companies having drilling rigs hooked up to the power of nearby communities and using electricity, which is even cleaner than using natural gas. So the industry does not get the credit they deserve. They're doing very, very, well, moving to where they need to. But it seems like Ottawa has deaf ears. They don't believe what they're hearing, or they just don't want to believe.
Well, when the environment minister is a guy who was charged when he belonged to Greenpeace for disrupting the public's access to buildings and so on, you don't really think you're going to get a fair hearing when you go to Ottawa.
Yeah, I would agree. Going back to that SVB, it's called Silicon Valley Bank. Sam, Veronica, Barry. Mm-hmm.
Well, anything else we should be keeping a close eye on right now, Joseph?
Well, I think that people should be getting their buy lists out. Stocks have come down quite a bit on the energy side. Also, energy service stocks have, and also we've seen some of the pipeline and infrastructure stocks come down. So we are getting ready, if this plunge that I see, develops, we'll be probably sending out action or advice to our subscribers. So anyone interested can go to www.schachterenergyreport.ca to see what we're doing, and there's some free samples on the product. But I think that, these kinds of shakeouts are quick and dirty. They're nasty when you look at your portfolios every day or you look at your statement from your broker. But these provide buying opportunities, and hopefully your listeners are sitting with cash on the sidelines to take advantage of the bargains that are developing.
Joseph, thank you so much for being on the show.
Oh, my pleasure as always, Jim. Take good care.
My guest has been Joseph Schachter, founder of the Schachter Energy Report, online at schachterenergyreport.ca. He was speaking to us from my hometown of Calgary. If you have any questions for Joseph, and we do have one, we have a couple of questions, so we can't slip away yet without asking those questions.
You better. I notice many companies in the oil and gas space report the regional differentials they receive relative to their benchmarks. Is there a way to track regional pricing in the U.S. and Canada for oil and gas on a daily basis, or can one only make educated guesses between quarterly reports? I think that there are services that are available for people in the industry, but you have to pay for them. You'll see AECO pricing. You'll see WCS differentials. Remember, there's also differences in the grade of crude. So the higher the API, in other words, the lighter the grade, the higher the price. And, of course, condensate trades at a premium. So unless you have access to the specific information, which is on the desk and you pay for it like a Bloomberg machine, you pay for the data. I don't have that, but it's possible to get it if you can afford to spend the money. Second question was, China overtakes U.S. refinery capacity, outlook lags. Are these refineries going to stay idle to optimally supply nothing to the empty cities all over China? What is the plan? Well, there are empty cities in China, but China, really has most of this refining capacity on the coastal areas, and they ship a product that, they buy the cheap Russian crude, which, instead of paying 75 for WTI and, let's say, 80 for Brent, they're buying it under $60, $54, $56 for U.S. They're creating the products that everybody wants, gasoline, diesel, the chemicals, and then they sell it into the markets nearby. And both India and China are both doing that. They both have very big refinery operations, they're both India and China are making a lot of money from their teapot refineries, which create product that they sell in the area. So while they're not using it in China, they are buying and taking advantage of a great bargain that Russia is giving them because of the sanctions, and they're using it to make very, very profitable, very high margin profits in their refining and marketing. And if you look at the refining and marketing, even of Suncor and Cenovus, a large amount of the profits are now in the downstream. The upstream is very profitable, but the downstream has become extremely profitable for North American companies and Canadian companies, as well, North American companies and companies on the R&M business, refining and marketing business all around the world are making record profits.
Joseph, thanks again.
My pleasure as always. Take good care, Jim.
We've been speaking with Joseph Schachter. I'm Jim Goddard.
Comments made on HowStreet.com radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com, HowStreet.com radio is a production of HowStreet Media Incorporated.